Good morning. The film Concussion opens tomorrow, and millions will see the story of the doctor who diagnosed the condition that led to the deaths of several football players and made the case for informed consent. Today, we look at the larger picture of traumatic brain injury. And with the coming legislative session, everyone has an agenda. We'll hear what's on the list for Hawaii's Aerospace Caucus. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. We'll talk with two seasoned instructors in the arts this morning. Hawaii Island artist Patty Pease Johnson teaches in three media, liquid dye on silk, soft pastel, and watercolor. And Daughters of Fire author Tom Peake wants aspiring writers to seek out that inner voice with writing on the wild side.
It's Thursday, December 24th, Christmas Eve day. Those conversations coming up after the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
Is there any doubt about what today may be?
I guess not. Not any longer anymore. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Chris.
Looking at aerospace from the Hawaii perspective.
Huh? Well, that's true. And given the fact that we may be very wrapped up in the holidays at this very moment, that hasn't stopped a lot of people looking forward and creating agendas for what is coming in the legislative session in about 3-4 weeks' time. Now, you might not immediately link Hawaii and aerospace, but Hawaii's Aerospace Caucus would have you think otherwise, particularly about the mission and programs of the Pacific International Space Center for Exploration Systems, also called PISES. It's one of the centerpieces of the agenda for the Aerospace Caucus. Senator Glenn Wakai is one of the co-chairs of the caucus, and we sat down after news broke that the Kona Airport Museum honoring Hawaii astronaut Ellison Onizuka would close in March.
I am a fan of retooling our airports around the state, so unfortunately the museum is a victim of that reinvention of our transportation needs. Ellison Onizuka left his mark on the state as well as the entire planet on what he and those in the Challenger did. So I hope that we get to reestablish that. I don't know if there's any specific discussions as to where and how much, but I am hopeful and pretty confident that we will have another Ellison Onizuka Museum someplace else on the Big Island.
The issue of the TMT obviously continues to go on and on. The Big Island very much centered in that discussion, and yet obviously it would affect us statewide. As the Aerospace Caucus is dealing with future issues, how are you considering what may happen with the TMT and what that may mean, depending upon which way it may go, for Hawaii?
That was a huge black eye for the state of Hawaii. Not just for aerospace, but economics in general. You look at the super ferry, gone. You look at TMT, potentially gone. We are not emboldening ourselves to the rest of the world for a great place to make investments. One thing that I think troubles TMT, though, is that we've had those set of telescopes on Mauna Kea for decades. But if you look at the people who work on the mountain, there are about 200 people who work on Mauna Kea. Less than 5% are local kids. When we think about the future of aerospace and job creation, it can't just be seen as let's create jobs. We have to also create pathways for local kids who go to the Ellison Onizuka Museum, who are inspired to have a pathway up to Mauna Kea. And, you know, you put the cultural discussions aside, there's still some troubles with the way we've looked at, implemented, and created all of those fantastic telescopes on Mauna Kea. The unfortunate situation with the TMT doesn't help us get to a better place, but maybe it's reason for us to pause to rethink the way we look at not just aerospace, but technology growth in general.
So what specifically would you like to see happen, you and the caucus?
I would like to see more than just kids having career days and internships, but really identifying a fifth grader who has his eyes on the stars and help him fulfill his dreams. take him from elementary school through middle school, provide more than just robotics classes, but have a program that's tailored for aerospace and in other industries as well, biology and chemistry and physics. But we can't just talk about STEM as kind of this generic, oh, science is good for everyone. It's got to be more strategic and more focused, that there's so many branches of science. Science doesn't mean that you're going to be a great biology chemist in the future if we're only going to focus on robotics. We've got to have a more holistic and more focused view on how we look at STEM education in the state.
Glenn McKay, you're also sounding as if you're talking about school within a school movement.
I'm all for that. I don't think the one-size-fits-all is the proper way to educate our children. Not every kid is going to go to college, but there can be someone who's like Jake Shimabukuro, who plays a ukulele and makes a gazillion dollars doing it. Someone who's a very successful auto mechanic. They're not failures because they didn't go to college, but we've created the entire educational system wrapped around the belief that success is only viewed in what kind of college you graduated from, what kind of degree you got, and how quickly you got that degree.
One of the programs that you've been trying to get fully funded that might help to bring some more success to Hawaii would be the Pisces program. Tried last year to get it fully funded, tried to get the laser optical communications ground station funded. Going to try again this year?
Yes, we are, amongst other things. Try to get money for a drone research facility. A number of things. You know, one of the struggles at the legislature is that not enough of my colleagues see the value in technology and the value in specifically in aerospace. We're so used to agriculture and tourism being the economic drivers. We're almost risk averse to go into this new area. And nothing ignites the human imagination more than space exploration. And, you know, unless we pivot a little bit of money into this arena, we're always going to be stuck as a service economy. And that's the difficulty in getting funding for Pisces, for the laser ground station, for a number of really neat opportunities for the state. You know, the idea of keep the country resonates well in some corners, but it's a hindrance for progress in other corners. I'd like to see us have one foot well grounded in our past, but our eyes on the future possibilities. And my frustration is really expanding the scope of what economic development is for the state of Hawaii. It's got to be more than just service industries.
Some would say that that has been helped by the idea that space exploration was more a thing of the past, and that's a different chapter in American history. And some who would try to revive it with another space program that people would buy into and that would ignite them culturally in the way that we saw happen with, say, the Apollo missions. Do we really need something like that to be able to galvanize political will?
We have lost excitement in Hawaii, lost excitement in America. I was still a young kid when man was setting foot on the moon. My name is Glenn Wakai. I'm named after John Glenn, the astronaut. And so that's maybe my bias towards enjoying aerospace. There's going to be a day when man will want to colonize the moon. Man will want to colonize Mars. That day hopefully will come sooner rather than later. We're just kind of in this dull, dead period of human exploration at this point because of other priorities. In the past, we've seen aerospace really driven by NASA, really driven by governments. Today, the biggest entity that sends things into space is DirecTV. That is an interesting evolution, but kind of, to me, shameful that a private sector who's sending us NFL football on Sundays is the greatest contributor to our space ventures. We should go back to the day when man could really push the envelope and look at what other universes are like.
The private sector is also driving interest in space and exploration in terms of entertainment. Do you see that there's a sort of a disconnect between what we enjoy and are just flocking to, Star Wars, and other of that genre, as opposed to what we're looking toward in reality?
I think they can go hand in hand. I think the Star Wars actually fuels people's interest in this arena. That bodes well for the opportunity. It's just a matter of how we're going to galvanize make-believe into real-life, tangible benefits for mankind. You look at the idea of space tourism, rocketing our tourists into the stratosphere for a zero-gravity experience. That's being fueled by the private sector as well. Google Galactic, Virgin Galactic. So I think we're going to have more private sector driving space exploration with hopefully some level of government oversight.
And finally, for this next session that's going to be here before we know it, what will mean a big win for you from all the things that are on your list and several which that we talked about today?
I would like to see us spend a lot more focus on economic development. We read in the paper a lot of times about the troubles of society for unsustainable programs, homelessness, healthcare, all important, I give you that, but all without any kind of payback for the greater community. Economic development is one of those areas where we pay very little attention to, but if we paid a bit more attention and more dollars and resources into investing into economic development, we would see handsome dividends to pay for better prisons, to pay for better hospitals, to pay for better schools. So I'd like to see this legislative session have a little bit more of its $13 billion plus budget devoted to economic development and a little bit less on some of these unsustainable programs that we continue to fund.
We'll talk more as the session progresses.
Look forward to it.
State Senator Glenn Wakai is the co-chair of the Hawaii Aerospace Caucus. We'll be talking with other caucuses in the coming weeks. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16, and coming up, more from Hawaii Island, where an artist breaks down the creative process. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're traveling back to 1981 for a look at a holiday television special set in Hawaii. It aired in December of 1981. Jim Neighbor's Christmas in Hawaii was an hour-long variety show featuring performances by actors and singers like Susan Anton, Carol Burnett, and Tom Selleck, as well as Neighbors himself. Local groups, the Brothers Casimiro and the Honolulu Boys Choir, were also featured in supporting roles. When the special aired, it was well-received by viewers, and it led to the release of the show's soundtrack on vinyl, as well as the actual TV special released on VHS tape. Throw Christmas in Hawaii was filmed in several recognizable locations in Hawaii. Many who have seen it remember Neighbors for singing in front of a particularly famous memorial on Oahu. For our quiz, we wanted you to tell us which memorial served as the backdrop while Jim Neighbors sang in some parts of the special Christmas in Hawaii. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Silver bells, silver bells, it's Christmas time in the city. Ring-a-ling, hear them ring, soon it will be Christmas.
Aloha, good morning. I'm Willow Chang from the Hot Club of Hulaville, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join The Conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Something's been lost in the arts since the days when students apprenticed themselves to masters of technique and spent part of their entire lives honing their skills at the easel or the potter's wheel. Patty Pease Johnson works in a variety of media and passes along the skills she's gained as a successful self-taught artist because she knows how technique can liberate the imagination. She's on the phone from her studio. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Chris.
Don't you think that technique can kind of, it seems like a thing that constrains you in a way, but it also liberates you, don't you think?
It can do both, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe people need to just be free with themselves If they don't know technique, that's just fine. They just can play with colors. And part of creating art is about just trusting your own intuition.
Agreed. At the same time, it often seems to me that technique can take you a lot further toward realizing those ambitions, don't you think?
Absolutely, yes. And that comes with practice.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously you get into the arts because you want to express something, you want to have a sense of play, but your workshops encourage more than that, it would seem.
My goal is to have beginners who may have never tried, for example, liquid dye on silk, on mm-hmm. a silk scarf, they don't have to come up with any supplies. I just want them to show up and have fun with their personal creative time.
So in that example of liquid dyes on silk, what do they need for that? Or what do you provide for that?
Well, their object is to paint an 8x53-inch scarf using three colors of their choice, which will create many more colors on the silk. So I supply the frame. It's like a floating frame they'll stretch it on.
Uh-huh.
And then I work with each student to mix their own colors, which is achieved by pre-mixing the four printing process colors, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. I just use percentages for everything, and that's how I mix. So you have a little creative side on your scarf, but then you got a little of your other side of your brain is working to mix these percentages.
The percentages of the four basic ones give you a variety of shades?
That's correct. All the different colors you can imagine. And then people use techniques of, I show them how to do color gradation and hard edges and using salt through painted samples. But I don't actually demonstrate for them because I don't want any of my work to influence theirs. So I want them to just use their intuition, what comes out of them.
So you kind of put the materials in front of them, let them make the discovery.
Absolutely.
What does the salt do? That's a new one on me.
It creates surface texture.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times I feel like just the tool who's putting the colors there, and they do their magic when they touch each other or if they're wet on wet or if it's wet on dry.
I lost you there toward the end, Patty.
Oh, I feel just like a tool and not making some decisions because when I put the colors next to each other with liquid dye, they do their own thing. And then when I add salt, it changes things much more, but I was just the tool that set it there.
Mm-hmm. And when you do a workshop like that, do you have some of your own work available sort of as an example of a finished product?
Yes, that's exactly what I do for the students. I show them how different techniques were achieved. I show them the sample and then explain how I got that.
What is the, I see a reference here to hot wax with the chanting tool?
Yes, in this, in a silk scarf class, the last hour, they do a sampler on an 8x8-inch China silk floated on the frame where they use the hot wax in a jaunting tool that's an Indonesian word for wax writing,
uh-huh.
where they draw out a more of a realistic shape or something for representational work. Let's say they wanted to do tea leaves.
Right.
And then you could paint inside the lines, basically, and so it wouldn't run all over like what I call freestyle when you're just using the liquid dyes themselves with no resist, which is what the wax is.
It sounds as if one of the characteristics of silk as a painting surface is that the colors spread and merge. Is that fair to say?
Very much so, yes. I believe it's freer than perhaps like oil or acrylic because they're liquid, they're fluid.
Yeah, makes sense. But the other media that you work in, that seems to be a sort of defining thread in your work, pastels, watercolors, colors that are kind of have soft edges, yeah?
Yeah, that's very true. I like soft pastel because number one is so immediate. You have the colors in the box, everything's pre-mixed. They're in the like the soft chalk sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's everything is so fast, but you can layer upon layer upon layer. And, in fact, I use sandpaper for my paper, which it has a lot of tooth, so it absorbs many layers.
Sandpaper like workshop sandpaper?
Pretty much, that's basically what it is. If you could get a big sheet of sandpaper, I buy them through art houses, but basically that is what it is, 400 grit, 800 grit.
I'm sorry, Patty. I lost the last part of what you said.
It's 400 grit sandpaper or 800 grit sandpaper.
And you just paint right on that, and then that surface allows you to add layers to it?
Yeah, exactly.
I've never heard of that as a medium before. But part of it seems it would seem that part of what you do, Patty, is just sort of introduce people to different tools and media, and then sort of get out of the way. Is that to describe you?
I love, Chris, yeah, how you said that. Yes, my mission is to light people up with the colors of life, whether it's my own personal work, they may be buying home accessories or fashion accessories, or when they become students and they light themselves up with their own colors.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes think that people have, well, I know, people seem to have their own, just as people have certain musical notes or a range of musical notes that really reach them, people tend to have their own color palette somewhere inside, don't you think?
Very true. So very true.
And so that's part of the rationale, I would think, for staying out of their way, because you don't want to impose that on them, right?
Exactly, yes. And in fact, many people come to a class wearing at least one of their favorite colors.
Ah, so you have a built-in clue right away as they walk in, huh?
Well, usually, yeah. I don't know, you know, say anything until when they pick their three choice of colors, and we'll use a color wheel, which I use a lot,
uh-huh.
But to help them decide maybe, you know, the other two, they're not sure, but oftentimes one of the colors they are wearing
will be reflected in their choices. That makes sense. Well, it sounds like fun, Patty, introducing people to the techniques the way you do. Thanks for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Patty Pease Johnson teaches art workshops in three media: liquid dye on silk, soft pastel, and watercolor, at various locations around Hawaii Island. She's got her own work in galleries and gift shops around the state, along with her original paintings.
It's Christmas in Killarney with all of the folks at home.
No, it's Christmas Eve in Havana after a year full of changes.
Not everything is fine, but people are expecting a little bit better opportunities for the Cuban people.
Catholics in Cuba and Christians around the world rejoicing. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
The The national campaign season is well underway, but locally, well, maybe not so much. But that may be changing, as rumors have been circulating this week that former Lieutenant Governor Duke Iona may enter the Honolulu mayoral race. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy holidays, Beth Ann.
You too. And dare we say it, Merry Christmas. taking a look at the column today that as sort of a follow-up of the conversation that you had with Duke Iona a little earlier this week, we still don't have any definites in all of this, but do you have any sense that he is really getting in? Because it's starting to sound a lot like he's really getting in.
Well, I spoke to him directly on Monday, and he would neither confirm nor deny, right? You've heard that one before. I will neither confirm nor deny. But, you know, he could have said no, and he did not. And when I asked him how he felt Kirk Caldwell had done as mayor, he said terrible. He really, in particular, took issue with homelessness, really having problems the way the mayor has handled that crisis. And then, of course, rail. Iona has always been against the rail project, but it's a city project. He was, of course, lieutenant governor and ran for governor, wouldn't have interfered. But he said, you know, being the chief executive of the city and county of Honolulu, he might very much have much more of a say. He particularly takes issue with what he calls just the outrageous financial cost of the rail for Oahu.
Did he give you any sense, though, of how he might act were he in that position right now today with things as they exist today?
No, he didn't show any of his cards, but you have to think about this. Here it is, almost 2016. The primary is less than eight months away or so, I guess. There's been no formal challenger, any name brand politician anyway, that has come forth to challenge Caldwell. You've heard Ernie Martin's name bandied about, the city council chair, but there's nothing official from him. Think about it. This is a very important position. Oahu is 900,000, a million people. It's a huge responsibility. The likes of Mufi Hanneman and Peter Carlisle and Jeremy Harris and so many others have had that job, Frank Fossey, for decades. Why hasn't there been anyone to come forward to challenge Kirk Caldwell? It makes one wonder, and I think Iona must be seeing an opening here.
Seeing an opening, but also having the numbers from past campaigns that might indicate that he could possibly have a success this time?
Well, just remember, this is a nonpartisan race, so he would not be running as a Republican. That could attract people. I mean, think about it. Hawaii is still very much of a blue state. It's hard for folks to vote Republican. They've never really been very successful, with the exception of course, Linda Lingle and Duke Iona as lieutenant governor. So I think he sees an opening. He certainly has been able to attract tens, if not over 100,000 votes in previous campaigns, low 100,000s. But, you know, those are the kind of numbers you need to compete for Honolulu mayor.
I mean, those numbers obviously coming from the Republican base, but looking at this, as you say, as a nonpartisan situation, still, will people forget that he is a Republican and just see him as being a really good choice?
I think the anti-rail vote is something you got to factor in. Remember how Ben Cayetano did pretty well. It looked like he was actually going to be mayor there 4 years ago against Kirk Caldwell, who, of course, is pro-rail. So if he can tap into that, tap into the Republican base, remember his religious conservative background as well, and certainly the homelessness issue is something that, well, a lot of us have opinions on. And so you could see a potential coalition to a winning ticket.
Before we go, I want to ask you about homelessness, because that was sort of, you know, part of his last campaign.
It was. I remember he actually proposed being able to take out, be able to go right into the homeless communities and help them in terms of getting them treatment. Remember that it was Lingle that surprised everybody when she was governor, saying, we've got to do something about this. And it was that administration that set up the Kaka'ako homeless shelter. It was only supposed to be temporary. It now has become pretty much a permanent fixture. But the Lingle Iona administration made homelessness a concern. Iona ran on it as a platform issue, unsuccessfully for governor. Certainly he feels he knows a thing or two about it, given his experience in the family and drug courts and so forth. And he thinks that maybe he could do better than Kirk Caldwell. At least that is what he's hinting at.
All right. Well, we'll see if that hint turns into a full-blown disclosure that he, in fact, wants to run. Thanks very much, and have a lovely, lovely Christmas Eve day, and good holiday tomorrow.
Thanks. Talk to you on Monday.
You bet. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. Thank you. Tomorrow, the intersection of where entertainment and news meet. Tomorrow, the film Concussion will open, and millions of people will learn about a specific type of brain injury that led to the death of several high-profile football players. But over 2 million people enter a U.S. emergency room with traumatic brain injury, and a new book offers some insight into how it happens so that family members and caregivers can better understand and help their loved ones. Duke University Medical Center neuropsychiatrist Sandeep Vaishnavi is the co-author of The Traumatic Brain. He joins us by phone from his office at Carolina Partners. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Vaishnavi, is this whole kind of focus on the film, which is spotlighting a particular form of brain trauma and its cause, is it in some way undercutting the ability to understand how pervasive traumatic brain injury really is?
Well, the good thing about this movie and just the publicity around concussions and brain injury is that I think it's allowing people to understand a little bit more about it and to really understand how common these things are. 70% of traumatic brain injuries are concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries, and that's really the focus of the movie.
The fact, though, that so many people come into an ER for some reason that has, you know, brought them a traumatic brain injury, you call that a silent epidemic. Is that why we really need to understand that this goes far beyond just a story that hit the headlines and that, you know, revolved around the NFL?
Yeah, absolutely. There, as you said, millions of people are brought into the medical system because of traumatic brain injury, but there are probably millions more that actually don't get to medical attention. And I think it's really important that people realize that even milder traumatic brain injuries, concussions, do need to be looked at. And it's not just at the NFL level. It's really with falls, with junior sports, with motor vehicle accidents. Any of these things can cause traumatic brain injury, anywhere from mild to really severe.
You just made the term mild, as in concussion. The film is called Concussion. Is that a misnomer, and does that not help the situation of understanding exactly what you've just talked about, that there are so many people who have a potential problem and don't even know it?
Yeah, the terminology is a bit confusing and maybe not the best, but we do divide traumatic brain injury into mild, moderate, and severe, and it's based on essentially if there is loss of consciousness or how long the loss of consciousness lasts, and also based on how long before new memories can be formed. So that's something called post-traumatic amnesia. But given that the word concussion is used commonly, especially in sports, and that's really equivalent to a mild traumatic brain injury. But the word mild is also a misnomer. I mean, nothing's really mild about a brain injury. And I think that's unfortunate that that's the term.
To give people a sense of what might cause them to go to an ER or what should cause them to go to the ER, what do you tell them, especially those people who figure, oh, no, I'm fine?
Well, so the main thing to get a diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury, it's not just that you hit your head. So if you walk into the wall, let's say, and you hit your head, that by itself does not mean it's a traumatic brain injury. You have to have dazing and confusion, even momentarily. So if you're disoriented, even for a second, well, that is a traumatic brain injury, and I think that it's worthwhile to get evaluated for that, at least to make sure that there is nothing significant going on in terms of bleeding in the brain. That's why people do CT scans in the emergency room. But oftentimes those CT scans, CAT scans are normal, but that doesn't mean there wasn't a brain injury. That means that you should really kind of monitor it and follow it over time.
In your book, you also make the very clear case that something physical, which most people would believe they need to go and have some treatment for, very often is linked to something that happens psychologically. We often see mental health somewhat subjugated to, you know, physical ailments and their needs. Is this really making the case for a lot more attention to mental health?
Absolutely. I think, again, it's a terminology problem, at least in part, or even a philosophical problem. I think we still, in general, as a society, we separate physical health from mental health. And in the book, in The Traumatized Brain, we make a big point about the different circuits in the brain that can be damaged by traumatic brain injury, and the fact that these circuits, once they're damaged, can lead to neuropsychiatric symptoms. They can lead to mood problems, behavioral problems, cognitive problems, which you describe as psychological problems, those are directly related to damage to certain parts of the brain. And I don't think that people really understand that there is this direct connection. So physical health and mental health are very much interrelated.
How can you make that case even more pronounced when you're talking about potentially having children involved with this? We see a lot of kids playing sports, been a lot of discussion about whether they should or should not be playing contact sports. And that's, you know, not just the only reason, but other parts of this argument, specifically as they reference children.
Well, yes, it is a complicated thing with children. We want to make sure that children get exercise. The sports is generally good for children. There's already an obesity epidemic in kids, so we want to make sure that they get exercise and they play sports. Lots of benefits with sports. But on the other hand, it's important to protect the head. It's very important to be prudent and to take precautionary measures, especially if there's head-to-head contact. That could be in the context of drills in football, or it could be in a football game, or with soccer or hockey, any of these sports. And I think especially with kids, you have to be very careful because the brain is developing. And I think it's important for people to understand that if they have these neuropsychiatric symptoms after a hit, well, that's something to really kind of be cognizant about and to monitor over time. And it's directly related to the brain injury.
And your point, very simply, is you can't just look at it as being just a physical thing only, and especially with children, paying attention to their moods and potential changes in those.
Absolutely. After a brain injury in sports, a mild traumatic brain injury or a concussion, we do see physical symptoms such as headaches and sensitivity to light and sound and dizziness, but we also see mood changes such as irritability or mood swings or depression. And we oftentimes see cognitive issues like trouble at paying attention and processing more slowly, and even memory problems.
Wish we had a lot more time to talk. Thank you so much for the time that you were able to give us today, Dr. Vaishnavi.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi is the director of the Neuropsychiatric Clinic at Carolina Partners. He's also a neuropsychiatrist at Preston Robert Tisch Brain Tumor Center at Duke University Medical Center. And he's also affiliated with Duke Departments of Psychiatry and Community and Family Medicine. He is the co-author of The Traumatized Brain.
Hi, good morning. I'm Avi Soifer from the William S. Richardson School of Law. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
In the show, we remembered Jim Nabors' Christmas in Hawaii, the 1981 TV special that was filmed here in the islands. It originally aired in December of 1981, and it featured performances by Jim Nabors, Susan Anton, Tom Selleck, and Carol Burnett, among others, including locally based Brothers Casimiro and the Honolulu Boys Choir. Following the original airing, the response from viewers was so positive that they wanted the soundtrack for Christmas in Hawaii, and it was released on vinyl. Though there are several locales featured in the special, many viewers cite Nabors' performances in front of a famous memorial on Oahu as among the most memorable. For today's quiz, we asked you what famous memorial can be seen as Jim Nabors is singing in some parts of Christmas in Hawaii. And the answer is the USS Arizona Memorial.
And Beth Ann, Liam Connolly of Kihei knew the answer to that, so a T-shirt is wending its way to him. And that's today's quiz, and if you've got one for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, announcing their annual Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations, February 1st through 4th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The rise of the blogger and the expansion of social media have brought with them an increase in the sheer number of words we're given to read, without necessarily giving us more in the way of good writing. On the positive side, it's refreshing to find that more and more of us are being moved to express ourselves through the written word, and a seasoned author and writing coach like Tom Peake, a novelist who lives on Hawaii Island, wants through his workshops to help newly minted writers find that distinctive voice within.
I think we're inundated these days with all kinds of talk and words from other people, celebrities, news pundits, and yet we're the people that are living in the world where the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all kinds of interesting stories, perspectives on what's happening in society. And so I always encourage people to write and to get to know what their own voice is and what their own views are and what their own stories are, and then to trust them.
Well, you know, as you said, Tom, there certainly is a flood of verbiage out there. I'm not sure I'm seeing a consequent growth of literary craft with it.
Well, I think part of that is that people are used to writing off the cuff without writing a practice that leads them to a deeper level of understanding,
mm-hmm.
or a deeper level of expression, or a their own unique way of expressing. And so we're actually encouraging people in this upcoming workshop who are bloggers, for example, or do a lot of things on Facebook, to come, because how do we apply some of the kinds of techniques that I've taught over the years, Natalie Goldberg's writing down the bones kind of things. How do we expose that group who are writing all the time but maybe haven't learned how to go deeper and further into their own unique way of expression?
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to just reproduce more verbiage that's a mirror reflection of all the other stuff in the social media and the blogosphere and the television. What we're really interested in, especially in Hawaii, which is a unique place, is what really fountains up or bubbles up from this kind of place in the kind of writing that people do. And
yeah,
that is likely to be very different. I think back to Daryl Lum's and Eric Chalk's sort of groundbreaking work many years ago, where they said, hey, how come we're not writing in the language we actually speak, which is pidgin?
Mm-hmm.
And they were standing there against a tsunami of sort of mass media, other kinds of communication. And as soon as they began to publish that stuff, there was this deep resonance in the island culture,
mm-hmm.
that said, hey, that's my voice.
Yeah.
Hey, that's my story. And I think that there are so many other aspects of life that are not being represented in literature, in storytelling, in the blogosphere, because people haven't learned how to make that connection between their life and their own writing. And that's what we hope to stimulate in the workshop.
A lot of the writing that is out there and on blogs and things like that strikes me, Tom, as kind of first draft writing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's not particularly crafted. It's not considered. It just sort of spilled out. And while there's some things about that, there are also some drawbacks to that, aren't there?
Yes. And, you know, in other kinds of workshops, I teach people how to take their first draft material and look at it in an intuitive way to go deeper and uncover more what they want to do. So that, you know, ultimately, people say, I have heard other writers say, good writing really is rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
But there's part of the reason for that problem in the blogosphere, I think, is also that the initial writing process is flawed in that people are often reacting to things they've read or seen or heard. So what they're writing is sort of, in a weird way, derivative of what they actually are reacting to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think I highly recommend to your viewers Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones, because that's a way that provides kind of a process through which people separate themselves from that inundation of verbiage, as you call it,
and
just sit down under a set of simple rules that is really a more natural way of, you know, what story is already in me? And I think that the blogosphere, and then write it without censorship, and then I agree with you that ultimately you want to edit those things, but there's a it isn't all at the back end. A lot of it's at the front end. It's how do you begin to immediately go deeper?
Mm-hmm.
And what Goldberg says is you need to be less self-conscious about what you're writing. Now, that sounds like a contradiction to quality writing, but actually, when we think of the very best writing, it's when it carries a kind of resonance, because the writer wasn't thinking, oh, this is my audience. I'm going to, you know, write something that I can feed to them. What happens is they're struck with a kind of revelatory moment or a deep set of emotions, and then they probe and probe and probe on their own, and then ultimately, through revision, they do that to the extent, to the point where they present then a really whole story that is a reflection of what they, as a person who've walked in the world, have experienced in the world and is now sharing to other people.
And a lot of times, Tom, the good stuff is there in the first draft. It just needs to be edited and polished and sort of brought to the fore, don't you think?
Yes, and in fact, what happens, what I've often told my writing students is that now go back and read the work, not to find out whether you're a good writer or not, but to, with compassion, look at what you've missed, particularly missed opportunities. Don't just look for the mistakes, because writing is a series of steps.
Mm-hmm.
The first step is to find out, well, what really is on your mind and get it out there. Once you let that get cold for a little bit and then go back and read it, it's amazing how you realize that first draft then propels you to a deeper level that's actually more to the point of why you sat down to write.
Mm-hmm.
And so people sometimes ask me, well, how many drafts is this novel, or how many drafts did you do this commentary for the advertiser or something? And I, you know, it's many drafts. Sometimes it's five drafts.
Sure.
Or in particular paragraphs, to get it exactly so the words are exactly what you really see and feel.
Tom Peak is the author of Daughters of Fire and a longtime writing coach. He'll give a workshop called Writing on the Wild Side on Saturday, January 23rd at the Volcano Art Center. And you can find out more about Tom and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose?
The answers to this holiday conundrum can be found in A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. It's back in an imaginative performance by Jonathan Winters.
Bah, humbug!
Reconsider the heart of the Christmas season. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join us for a special presentation of A Christmas Carol from NPR.
This afternoon at 5, right after Says You.
And while we have lots of program notes coming at you, a few more. Just a moment ago, we talked with Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi, and he'll be on with Dr. Kathy Kozak on Monday for a much longer conversation about the traumatic brain. Now, tonight's Town Square and tomorrow's conversation are also preempted for a lot of holiday fare, so we hope you'll enjoy that, and we'll be back on Monday.
And we're wishing everybody a great holiday weekend.
We hope you have a wonderful holiday weekend. And if during that time you want to be in touch, well, you can do that because our talkback line is available anytime you want it. The number is 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Just know we'll probably not be able to answer it until about Monday or so when we recover a bit. You can also post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And you can hear podcast files of our past shows on the HPR2 archive, along with links to information about guests and topics we cover on the show. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on the website hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We will see you on Monday. Have a very, very Merry Christmas.